Next, we have Brian Dunnigan, professional engineer, and Jim Schneider, PhD. They hail from Olson Associates in Nebraska. Prior to their time at Olson Associates, they worked for the Nebraska Department of Natural Resources, where they were instrumental in building, as I understand it, building Nebraska DNR's groundwater modeling program, and implementing water law there. So it should be good. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. Thank you to the association for having Jim and I come up and talk to you. We're really excited to be here and hope that a few of our experiences over, especially the last 10 years, may resonate with you and may help you in some of your discussions and issues. And boy, do we have a lot of experiences. We're going to start out really by kind of giving you a perspective of Nebraska, both from a hydrologic standpoint and also from a legal standpoint. It's much different than Minnesota, but and very unique, and it really really does set itself up for some unique challenges, as you'll see. We're also going to talk about groundwater modeling in Nebraska from the very origins of our groundwater models to where we are today. And we're going to talk about some of the conflicts that have happened over the years. And those conflicts really have been a catalyst for change in Nebraska. We don't do anything very proactively. It takes a little bit of a push for us to do things. And it's always, almost always in water law, has been the result of some factor that's usually not very good, that we've changed the way that we do business. And lastly, we want to talk a bit about the integrated management program in Nebraska, which started to address some of these issues that we've had over the years, and I think is really promising going forward. I might not have said that a few years ago, but I'll say it now. When we look at the kind of the hydrologic setting of Nebraska, you can see that the variability in precipitation is great across the state. Most of you, or some of you that may have driven across Nebraska, may say, oh, the only thing I know about Nebraska is it takes a long time to drive across. Well, that's true, but the variability ranges from about 36 inches of precip, annual precipitation, in the very southeastern part of the state to somewhere around 14 inches in the west. So if you were thinking about that drive from eastern Nebraska entering the state into Omaha and leaving the state somewhere out west near Sydney, you'd have as much variability in precipitation as you'd have if you drove from Boston to Omaha. So it's a very unique setting, but it is interesting and has some unique features. When we look at the water availability, I'm going to start out with surface water availability, and you can see that the water really picks up as we go from the western part of the state to the eastern part of the state. This representation by the width of the stream shown there really indicates the amount of flow. We often say that we have about 1 million acre feet of water entering the state on the west end of the state and about 7.1 million acre feet leaving, and I think that number down at the bottom is staggering, about 86 million acre feet of precipitation. So it's not that it doesn't rain in Nebraska, and it's not that we don't have lots of water in Nebraska. It's really a matter of if we have water when we want water in Nebraska. We're the number one irrigated state in the United States. We irrigate about 8.2 million acres. We also have the most stream miles of any state in the country, about 24,000 miles of stream. So again, fairly unique. When we look at the groundwater resource, it's even more interesting. We sit on the heart, really, of the Ogallala Aquifer, the sweet spot, so to speak. We have upwards of 1,000 to 1,200 feet of saturated thickness in the Ogallala sitting under Nebraska. We have about 2 billion acre feet of water under the state. Again, it's not that we don't have water in Nebraska. It's if we have water when we need it. The Ogallala Aquifer, by the way, has been referred to as the largest aquifer in the United States and one of the largest aquifers in the world. when we kind of track the path of both surface water law and groundwater law in Nebraska, you'll notice that they're on separate tracks. And they have remained on separate tracks for most of the history of the state of Nebraska. It's not until very recently did they kind of merge together into something different. On the surface water side, we can go all the way back to 1895 with our prior appropriation doctrine. And we'll talk about some of the things that are really interesting about the surface water part of Nebraska. We first started seeing diversions out of rivers in about 1850, and that was in the very arid western part of the state. We had high spring flows coming out of the Rocky Mountains on the North Platte River, and it set up really nicely to divert some of that water, because that water was coming into Nebraska after the melt and might come in June, which was early July, which might be really good times for irrigation. So those are some of the first things that happened. We started out in 1889 with a prior appropriation doctrine that was revised in 1895, and we've pretty much operated under that doctrine since 1895 with some changes, but not a whole lot of changes. We were very late coming to the in-stream flow appropriations, not until 1984, so again, very reactive to what's happening around us. Nebraska is a state like many of the western United States. We have a number of interstate compacts and decrees that we must comply with. These decrees and compacts were really agreements with the federal government and the adjoining states on how water was to be appropriated, and really an equitable apportionment of water in each of those compacts or decrees. That South Platte Compact of 1923 was actually the second United States compact that was approved in the United States, so that was really about the start of it. And as recently as 1971, we entered into the Big Blue and Little Blue River Compact. When we look at groundwater regulation, we didn't really do anything with groundwater in the state. In fact, it really wasn't used that much until 30s, 40s, 50s, and then really developed after that. We had a case in 1933, Olson versus the city of Wahoo, that looked at groundwater and for the first time said, well, there aren't any laws that govern groundwater in Nebraska, so we'll have to look back at common law and we'll have to rely on correlative rights under common law to really say how Nebraska or how the court looks at groundwater. And that's the doctrine that we've operated under and still operate under today, is a modified correlative rights doctrine, which basically says that the landowner has reasonable use subject to correlative rights, or another way to say it is, in times of shortage, share and share alike. The 1975 Groundwater Management Act was really the first big piece of legislation that came forward on how we were going to manage groundwater in Nebraska. And you can imagine that there was a ton of groundwater development that occurred both before 1975 and after 1975. One of the things that that piece of legislation did was delegated the regulation of groundwater to local natural resources districts. And I want to explain this animal to you. Nebraska is again unique in this form of government. Natural resources districts were formed. Their boundaries basically follow or are aligned with watersheds, and they combined about 150 special purpose entities into 24 districts, which the legislature then could give responsibilities to. They have local taxing authority and local elected officials, and that does create a bit of a bind. Right now there are 23 natural resources districts. There were originally 24. With that, I'll let Jim.
Great. So Brian alluded to it a little bit in talking about the groundwater development in Nebraska, and we've got some nice slides that kind of show how that took off. You might be wondering, well, in 1975, what were they worried about with regard to groundwater use? Well, here it was in 1940, and in fact, most of the wells existed along the Platte River, and they were actually primarily hand dug wells, if you can believe that. So I can't. So going forward from 1940, this was kind of how we developed with regard to groundwater. 1960, and then 1980. So that was what they were facing when they passed those regulations in 1975 that indicated that provided for the authorities to start managing groundwater. So obviously the next question that you might imagine they asked is, well, what's going to happen? If we have all this use out there, what's going to happen? And in order to answer questions like that, geologists turned to groundwater models. And actually the first groundwater model looked a lot like this. If you haven't seen one of these before, this is an electric analog groundwater model. It actually uses resistors and capacitors to simulate the flow of groundwater movement in an aquifer. And this isn't the actual model. This is a model that's on display at the Illinois State Water Survey. But the very first model was developed for, as you might imagine, this area right there. And it was an electric analog model. So ModFlow came out in the early 80s, and at the same time, the USGS was given the authority to do these regional aquifer system analyses, or the RASA studies, if you've heard of those. So there was a series of reports that came out regarding the entire High Plains aquifer, including obviously what they termed the Northern High Plains aquifer, which was the area that Nebraska fell in. These are a couple covers. This report here basically characterized the aquifer, and then they did some simulations of the effect of future groundwater pumping on that aquifer. So this is a little better than that big circuit board that I just showed you before, but this is what the model looked like back in the 80s. These grid cells are 8 miles on a side. So as you can imagine, that even if you're not a modeler, that's pretty coarse. You're using 64-mile square grid cells, and you get one head value per grid cell. To go along with that, to represent the rivers, we have to put those over the model, and you get the grid cell is either a river or it's not. There's nothing in between. And of course, this was the river package in ModFlow, if you're familiar with that. So nothing like the more the packages we use now, like the stream package. So they did their simulations, and this is what was projected for water level changes from 1980 through 2020. And everyone said, oh my God. You can see here, this is, if you can't read these, this is up to greater than 200 feet of drawdown. In these darkest red areas. So the NRDs braced for this. They all developed groundwater management plans. All the groundwater management plans had water level triggers in them that required certain actions. How you might set triggers for water quality when nitrates get to certain levels. They set triggers for levels of drawdown, and those were required to initiate successively more stringent regulations as those water levels dropped. And this simulation, to some extent, incorporated the concept that development wasn't going to stop. There were no laws at the time and in fact, the entities didn't have the ability to implement a moratorium on groundwater use. They could only limit its use as necessary. So let's look at what actually happened going forward from 1980. You saw this one before. And then as we go forward to 2000 and 2009. So the problem didn't get any better, obviously, just with regard to the development that was allowed to happen. So what actually did happen? Well, here's a map from 2009. Pre-development to spring of 2009, the current map actually looks very similar, but I wanted to match it with that well map. And the key here, it shows that we have Most areas, maybe 10 to 20 feet of drawdown, a couple isolated areas of 50 to 60 feet of drawdown. So, you know, the impression I get is that Nebraska kind of collectively felt like they'd won the lottery. You know, it's free water. You can use it and nothing goes wrong. You know, those projections were bogus. Everything's fine. Of course, as most of us, I'm sure, are well aware, there's no free lunch. There is more to it than they were able to simulate with those early models. So part of the issue was the 80s and 90s happened to be particularly wet. So, you know, they ran the model with the assumptions they made, but those assumptions did not drive the future. The future happened as it so pleased. And I showed you the representation of the rivers in the model, of course, very crude. And the modelers knew that as water levels dropped, those rivers would potentially dry up. And so they made some guesstimates of when they had to remove those rivers from the model. Those did not turn out to be true. Most of those streams are still flowing today, although many have seen significant declines. It's notable that they did similar models for the central and the southern high plains, and if you compare the projections back in the 80s to water level declines that they've seen through today, there's a high degree of correlation. So something different was happening in the northern high plains, obviously, and management, certainly one of them, people became very aware that the situation needed to be managed, and farmers became more proactive. They didn't want to be regulated, so they did things voluntarily. And of course, the other thing that the central and southern high plains don't have that we do, which is flowing streams. But obviously, that points to the reason why water levels didn't drop as much. It's this simple little graph here. As you put in wells in and around streams, a lot of the water that you're pumping is actually depleting stream flow and not the aquifer. And as you can imagine, by simply monitoring water levels, they weren't getting the full picture. Water levels are great, but they're not, and they're necessary, but they don't tell the full picture with regard to what's happening with depletions to stream flow. So we've made this graphic to kind of help illustrate what was really going on, in fact. And you can imagine if you go set out driving based on a projection from a model simulation or a guess at where you're going, and you just stare in the rearview mirror for verification that you're actually passing the things you thought you were going to be passing, you might feel like you're going in the right direction. But obviously, this isn't the approach we all use when we go driving, because we know sooner or later we're going to run somebody over. There's going to be a bump in the road, and inevitably that bump came for Nebraska. And that came with the Republican River Basin. Brian mentioned the compacts and decrees that Nebraska's involved in. One is the Republican River Compact with Kansas. It divides up all the surface water in the basin, and each state gets a certain amount. And Kansas had been complaining, starting in the 80s, that Nebraska's excessive groundwater pumping was depleting stream flow and robbing them of their share of the river. And it wasn't being accounted for within the computations the compact administration did. Finally, they were fed up, and in 1998, they filed an original action with the United States Supreme Court. That's where these interstate disputes go, is directly to the Supreme Court. And this was our brilliant defense. It's a surface water compact. Groundwater doesn't count. Well, after they learned a little bit more about it, the court said, of course it does, to the extent that it depletes surface water. And so they were forced to develop a groundwater model. Actually, the states worked together on it initially to revise the accounting and to incorporate the depletions of groundwater into compact computations, which meant that Nebraska was now going to have to do some regulatory things with regard to groundwater for the purposes of surface water. That turned out to be a little bit of a problem, because at the same time, a surface water appropriator sued the state for not protecting its water right against the use from groundwater users. And the state Supreme Court ruled the state has no authority to regulate groundwater users for the benefit of surface water users. Whoops. And coincidentally, the NRDs did not have the authority to regulate groundwater for the benefit of surface water users either. So you can see how this kind of comes together and creates a crisis. And Brian's going to talk about where things went from there.
Or didn't go, Jim. Here's the structure that we have set up, and you can probably recognize some of the conflict here. We have groundwater under one regulatory structure, the modified correlative rights system. Again, not a prior appropriation or a first-in-time, first-in-right system. And we have it managed locally by 23 natural resources districts. On the surface water side, we have the prior appropriation system, been in place since 1895, appropriations on the books since 1895, and that is regulated by the state through the Department of Natural Resources. And we have not fully recognized the connection and the conflict between groundwater pumping and surface water flow. Right around 2000, Jim mentioned that the interstate litigation with Kansas started in about 1998. The catalyst comes to say, hey, you know, if we don't do something, we're going to be sitting in front of a special master and then ultimately in front of the Supreme Court with this argument that we really don't know what happened, but we have to do something. Maybe we should do something proactive before we get to that time period. So one of the things that was done was the Water Policy Task Force was formed in 2002 by a legislative act, and it was tasked with trying to figure out and untangle some of these problems that we were in because of the dual regulatory structure and the local state control of water. That task force made a recommendation in the end of 2003, right before the 2004 legislative session, to work some of these things out. And the governor signed that bill in the middle of that legislative session. And it really provided the mechanisms to start working together, for the state to start working with the groundwater management, with the natural resources district, and looking at how surface water and groundwater really interact and how they should be managed. The other thing that it established was a provision where the state could designate basins as fully appropriated. So we're starting to get a little bit of traction. The road now on integrated management is kind of interesting. We talked about the passage of LB 962 in 2004. The next really big thing that, in my opinion, that came around, which was part of the Water Policies Task Force recommendation, was that there needed to be a funding source to be able to work through some of these problems that the development of groundwater had caused the state, and the state should be a player as well as the local districts. So in 2014, the Water Sustainability Fund was passed. There was a lot of debate on how much money the state should put into that. Ultimately, what the state ended up putting into that and remains today is about $10 million a year of appropriation, and that has to match 40% with a local match, which is usually a natural resources district because they do have money and can match. So that's where the projects come from, to now be able to start addressing some of those problems that we created in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. There's a number of benefits to that combined approach of water management where you're actually on the same page, so to speak. But one of the biggest things is the state could now support the development of integrated management plans, work directly with the natural resources districts to address these problems instead of two entities standing across from each other, fighting on every issue that came forward. And believe me, that was the case up until just a few years ago. There's also a lot of insights at the local level that we can't do away with. We know that management, especially of groundwater, occurs most effectively at the local level. And when you see the difference in the topography, precipitation, what's grown across the state, it can't be a one-size-fits-all. And you can imagine the problem if it was being directed out of Lincoln, Nebraska for irrigators, say, in Scott's Bluff. Just wouldn't work, wouldn't have the local buy-in that it needs to have. And those combined funding sources, tremendously important. The NRDs can not only have a levy, but they can also have occupation tax levied against irrigated acres. So they can generate a lot more money than the state can generate.
Thanks, Brian. So I'll talk a little bit more about how this process works. Brian mentioned the integrated management plans that are developed. They're a really interesting animal. By statute, they are not developed locally and sent to the state for approval. What occurs is they're developed in jointly by these NRDs with the DNR, and they jointly adopt them through separate orders. The director signs an order adopting the plan and the surface water controls. The board of the NRD adopts an order adopting the plan and the groundwater controls. And they're required to address the conflicts that are occurring between surface water and groundwater users. In some cases, like in the Republican, it's also required to address interstate compact issues. We kind of set out, if you're familiar with adaptive management in general, this is the general approach that we applied to this integrated management planning process. So you assess the management setting. Once you understand, you can predict, implement, and monitor and review. And of course, you can see this is iterative. In the Republican River Basin, we've done this loop 4 times to date since 2005. Fortunately, that didn't get us into too much trouble. When you have to redo this, it means something didn't work. And that's exactly what happened after we settled with Kansas on the first round. We took the very first opportunity to violate that settlement in 2006. I like to remind people that I was hired in November of 2006, so I had nothing to do with that.
I'd like to say I was in floodplain management at that time.
Yeah. Brian got dragged in after that. So we were faced with having to redo this. We did that and brought that before an arbitrator. And he said, "I don't know, guys. It sounds good, but I don't know why. I just have to take your word for it, and that's not good enough." So we did it again and implemented more strict backstop regulations. And that actually then had to be defended. That third round of plans had to be defended in front of a special master that was appointed by the Supreme Court when Kansas sued us the second time. And he approved those plans as being adequate to avoid a future violation. So we got out of that one. It was dicey, though, believe me. And they've actually since modified that a fourth time. And many other areas of the state are just getting to the end of this first iteration, and then it's everywhere in between. And so that's how the process will work going forward as things change, because we know. One thing we know is we don't know the future and what ways, the way that water needs are going to manifest in the future, climate, all of those things that we can't control. And so it's set up to be flexible. Obviously, if we're going to be managing surface water and groundwater, we need groundwater models to be able to understand both what's happened and what might happen in the future. So when I showed up, we had this model down here, and they'd been working on this model. So this was about 12 years ago. They are just finishing the models for Eastern Nebraska right now. So over about 10 years, got to the point where there are regional models covering the entire state. The only area, there is no groundwater up here, so there's nothing to model. Recognizing the kind of the failure of projections from the past, implemented a much more flexible approach, similar to that iterative process of planning, to recognize that we can run these models to understand what has happened, what are the current depletions to stream flow from groundwater use, we can do a few projections forward, and we should do more than one. But we shouldn't just take those and say this is the universe. We should continue to reassess those projections, and they do this anywhere from annually to on a 5 or 10 year rotation, so that they're updating the models to make them current, and looking at how that, you know, the changes that have happened in that time frame might reflect in the new assessments of what might happen in the future. We've moved on to develop a lot of sub-regional models. You can see this is just that one little area right there. We've actually developed these at Olson for a couple NRDs over the last year. And we're able to use more advanced mod flow techniques, such as unstructured grids. And we've even developed automated tools so that managers, stakeholders, publics can actually run these models in their own office and ask different questions of the models without being groundwater modelers. So we feel like we're no longer staring in the rearview mirror and acknowledging that we have a windshield and we should look forward and check the rearview mirror every now and then. So with that, thank you. We'd happy to answer questions if there are any.
Thank you, that was great. In terms of the model from the 1980s, how did the actual appropriations differ from what you modeled at that time? So you looked forward 20 or however many years it was. Did the projections match up at all in terms of what you thought would be pumped?
Well, I would say, you know, everything changed in the early 2000s, and that's when some moratoriums and whatnot went into place. I think from through the 80s and 90s, it was pretty... It matched up pretty good. They kind of based that on what land was out there left that could be developed, could be converted from irrigated from dry land to irrigated, and much of that did occur by the early 2000s.
My wife and I were traveling out west a couple of years ago, listening to public radio, and there was a program about the Oglala Aquifer, and they predicted that within 20 years, that aquifer would be exhausted. Now, is your management plan going to make that prediction completely false, or should I hope to live long enough to see the Oglala dry up?
Yes.
Come to Nebraska.
Yeah. Yes and no. There are areas in Kansas and Texas, Oklahoma, where that is very much the case. They're just going forward and saying we're going to use what's left, and then we'll move on. Right. But not in Nebraska. In fact, I was going to say, when you look at that, if you average those water level changes from pre-development, the average change in water level in Nebraska is less than 1%. Yeah.
You did a very nice job of explaining sort of how you did the what, which is the integration for water management. But I'd like to know who was involved in that elaborate process. How many different stakeholders, actors did you have to pull into that process to get at integration for sustainability?
Well, I'll start and I'll let Brian comment if he has other thoughts, but that original task force was 49 members, and they represented all walks of life in Nebraska. And then when we went to develop the integrated management plans with each NRD, that process involved a stakeholder group of stakeholders within that NRD as well. And those groups ranged in size from say 10 to maybe 30 or so, that process lasted from a few months to as much as 5 years before, and the general goal was always to try to work towards consensus, if possible.
Right, and I think when we talked about that NRD being a unique structure, that was one way that was really effective in making sure that all the voices were heard, because all 23 natural resources districts had a stake. They had board members, they had citizens that were involved. So it was really 23, constantly 23 natural resources districts, plus the state making comments on how to move forward. And then ultimately, when you think about the socioeconomic pieces of the state, the legislature had a great role to play in that also. on how we had developed, how we were going to keep developing, and what we were going to do. So a lot of politics mixed in with a lot of common sense, with a lot of technical pieces.
I was wondering if you guys could expand a little bit more about the NRDs, because that's a really different concept than we have here in Minnesota.
Sure. I wasn't quite around yet when the NRDs were formed, but very shortly thereafter. So I've worked with the NRDs for a lot of years. And I mentioned just in passing that the relationship, especially the regulation relationship, hasn't always been easy between the states and the local unit of government. When you think of locally elected boards, you know as well as I do that those locally elected boards have interests too, and some of those interests drive their local politics and policies, and it's not hard to understand that those can definitely be in conflict with what some of the state priorities are and some of the laws, especially with compacts, are. So it hasn't always been a smooth relationship in water management, but the NRDs do a lot more than just manage groundwater. They manage all of their natural resources and have many programs related to soil and erosion control, recreation, trails, a lot of different things that they're involved in. And again, the local flavor of what the wants are of the local population are very important. And I think once we got over some of these water question hurdles and now are moving forward with integrated management, I think they have come to maturity now and can really operate much like they were intended to operate with some of the authorities that they were given. And the state, I'm not saying the state is not without some overreach here too. The states had to be very careful in how they treat the natural resources districts and making sure that everybody's playing by the rules that the legislature outlined, if that helps.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jim and Brian.